is completely determined by the value of the 2 and the 3 point functions. That's statement number one. So let me write the statement. The statement is that CFT correlators, which in a sense means the whole theory, are completely determined from the knowledge of the 2 and the 3 point functions. So that's one statement. This follows from the OPE essentially, from the operator product expansion that we discussed. And theorem number two is that even though the higher point functions are determined in terms of the lower point functions, the 2 and the 3 point functions, that the 4 point function imposes nonlinear constraints on the CFT data. And by the CFT data is the data that's determined by the 2 and the 3 point functions, which remember was the collection of anomalous dimensions. This could be read from the 2 point function. And the structure constants that could be determined from the 3 point functions, which remember were completely, the position dependence was completely fixed by conformal invariants by virtue of the special conformal transformations and dilatations, the additional symmetries that you have there. Notice that we're studying all this story from an axiomatic point of view. We're discussing just the properties of operators and correlation functions, never being married to a Lagrangian description of the CFT. And this point of view is very powerful because, in a sense, it tackles directly the conformal field theory that you want to study, instead of studying a possible ultraviolet realization of the conformal field theory that you may get by tuning some parameters. Like, for example, what happens when you study the Ising model? You can get the Ising, the second order phase transition by tuning the temperature, the Curie temperature. The Ising model has both a lattice and a continuum description. And these are two different things. And then by tuning the parameter, you hit the fixed point. You could try to study the fixed point by studying either the lattice description or the field theory description. Both become very strongly coupled near the critical point, so it's not useful, not very useful. And instead, what we're doing is we're just postulating that there's a CFT, there's a collection of operators with symmetries, and these are the correlation functions. And let's try to get as much information about the CFT just from this axiomatic point of view. Good. So what we also saw is that the 4 point function is already not determined completely by symmetry. Okay. So we noticed that the 4 point function, and one way that we argued that is that you can move 4 arbitrary points by conformal transformations into a plane. 3 of them are fixed wherever you want, and 1 lives at a point in the plane. Okay, so the correlation function will necessarily depend on a complex parameter or 2 real parameters. Okay, and there are several ways of parametrizing those parameters. These are cross ratios, and these are variables that are invariant under conformal transformation, and therefore. If you demand that the correlation function is conformal invariant, you can have an arbitrary function of them a priori, because if you hit with the conformal transformation, it kills it, because it's conformal invariant. So what we saw is that if I say the 4 point function of a scalar operator, so all this is to build up to kind of try to solve or say something powerful, and this was done recently, about the critical exponents or the scaling dimensions of the 3-dimensional Ising model. So what we found here is that up to some trivial factor, I'm not sure I get it right. The correlation, conformal symmetry doesn't tell you more at this point than just that you can have an arbitrary function here. And each theory and each correlation function will have a different function. And at this point, this looks arbitrarily complicated. So then what did we do? Okay, so now at this point, we did something that looked, okay, and maybe I should define what the U and B were. So these were cross ratios, right? So this was. Remember that xij is the distance between I and j, and v you can get from here to here by replacing 1 and 3. So this will be x14 squared x, let me try, x23 squared, x13 squared, x24 squared. Okay? And the nice property about these variables is that they're conformal invariant. Okay. Now at this point, and we don't know nothing at this point, this function. One thing that's obvious from the form of the correlator is that the correlation function is invariant under arbitrary permutations of the points. Okay. So if I permute 1 and 3, I could remember this is an equation that we wrote before. This I could have written also as 1 over x23 to the 2 delta phi. So here I'm just choosing a permutation of 1 and 3. Here I get x14 to the 2 delta phi. And since 1 and 3 exchanges v and u, I get g of v and u. Okay? Now, this equation we could write in a way that looked a bit nicer, more covariant, by saying that v to the delta phi times g u v, the function we know nothing about, times u to the delta phi g v u equals 0. Okay, but we had no known way of computing this function. Okay, and that's where we introduced the notion of the OPE. Okay, so now here is the crucial step. So we define the notion of an OPE, and remember the idea was that you replace the product of two operators by an infinite sum of local operators, okay? So, and the way we did it is like, you take phi x1, phi at x2, you essentially expand around the point x2, like a Taylor series, and here you sum over all possible operators. I'm gonna use this label A. Some structure constant F phi phi O, sorry, let me call it sum over O, times CA x12, derivative with respect to the x2 coordinate, acting on primary operators OA at x2. So essentially what this does is you represent this by the most general operator you can have on the right-hand side. That's typical of quantum mechanics, you sum over everything. So here I write the most general thing you can write down. But since we have conformal symmetry, this allows us to organize our states and operators into families. So the sum over O is the sum over primaries. So you have above two dimensions, the number of primaries, you can prove that it's infinite. So you sum over all the infinite primaries. And this gadget here essentially is the contribution of to the OPE of all the descendants associated to the primary OA. Okay? Remember, the descendants are just stupid derivatives. Stupid, but it becomes nasty derivatives. Okay? And what we showed is that this function, actually, first of all, we showed by plugging this OPE into the three-point function that this guy is precisely C phi phi O. The coefficient of the three-point function between two phi's and O, and O, and that this guy is fixed by conformal symmetry. And is straightforwardly computable by looking at the three-point function of phi, phi, OA. This allows you to compute explicitly what this function is. Yes?
So what was the precise statement about how the infinite number of primary fields?
So that that you can prove, I didn't prove it, but that in order for the crossing symmetry equation that we will discuss in a moment to have a chance of being true, that above two dimensions, in order for the singularity structure of the crossing equation around a particular point, in order to reproduce a singularity in one channel, it implies that this is only possible if you have an infinite number of operators in the other channel. Okay. Now, that's not true in two dimensions. In two dimensions, there's something called the minimal models that have a finite number of primary operators. So these are very complicated sums. I mean, so maybe last time I got lost trying to write too many details. I think it's more important that you understand what the physics than anything else. Okay. And what we said is that this expansion is valid inside correlation functions. Okay. So here you have other operators. As long as x12 is smaller than x2, any other operator. So essentially what it means is that you have the point x2, you have the point x1, you draw a sphere around it. All other operators have to be outside this sphere. Let's call it x other. And you can convince yourself, actually, this you may have as an exercise. You can just to convince that this is true. There are formal arguments to say that it's true, but this would take us to maybe too far afield. You can just take the correlation function of a free field theory, do the OP in the free field theory, and show that you would reproduce the answer you would get from trivial Wick's theorem using the propagator the OP reproduces the full correlation function in terms of the propagator if this condition is obeyed. Well, essentially you get a power series, and that power series is convergent only if this is true. Okay, so now then, the next step was that we use this to compute the four-point function. So now let's try to compute the four-point function using this idea. Notice that while the abstract correlation function had complete symmetry in 1, 2, 3, 4, right? All operators are the same. When I do an OPE, I'm breaking that symmetry. I'm specifying who is close to who, okay? So now let's do the OPE in the 1, 2 channel, okay? So there are several ways of writing it. Essentially then, by plugging this in, what you're going to get is what? You're going to get the sum over O of C phi phi O, this function that's completely fixed by conformal symmetry, of the three-point function of OA at x2, phi at x3, phi at x4. So I've reduced the four-point function to a three-point function by colliding 1 and 2 together. Okay. Yes.
Are you doing the OPE in that picture you do with the circle around x2? Or like you're expanding around x2?
Yes.
Yeah. And there's x1 in the middle of that circle?
Sorry, I think it's screwed up. But this should be centered around x2. I think the sphere should be right.
Yeah.
So, yes. So this should have been whatever this thing means. Yeah. Yes. Yes, you're right. Sorry. Okay. And now we know that the three-point function, again, is completely fixed by conformal symmetry. Okay. So that's one evaluation of the four-point function where I'm colliding x1 with x2. Now, I could have chosen to collide. And we can draw this picture. So have 1 collides with 2, and then have 3 and 4. Now I can collide instead. So that's one representation. Oh, by the way, and this defines for you this function GUB, right? GUB is a function that we didn't know about that defines the four-point function. Now what the OPE tells is that GUB is essentially this thing, okay? So actually, something that's convenient to do is to let me divide this by C phi phi O and multiply it with a square here, okay? So that this gadget here It's just a pure function of coordinates and dimensions. Doesn't depend on, on this tensor. Okay. So this GUV, I mean, I could write it again, but it's just mentally in your head. Equate this with this, and this defines a function GUV. Okay. So GUV is completely fixed in terms of the C's. The position dependence of the conformal invariants and the dimensions of phi and these OAs and the spins and all of that stuff. But I could have also computed this by doing the OPE in a different way. And that's what gives us the constraint. So, and I could instead do the OPE between 1 and 4. So what am I going to get? It's a different representation of the same function. So I get C phi phi O square C A X 1 4 D 4 acting on phi X 2 phi X 3 O A X 4. And for good measure, I'm gonna divide the same thing. Phi. So this is an yes.
Just for clarity. On the right-hand side, OA is also primary, right?
Yes. Yes, I mean, in this OP, you always decompose the sum into primaries, and the contribution of the descendants is encoded into that function CA with all kinds of derivatives. OK. But now, so I give two different representations of the same four-point function. If there is a regime in which both expansions are valid, these two things have to agree. And if they agree, this gives you a crazy relation between infinite sums of complicated functions that depend on structural constants and dimensions to another crazy infinite sum of functions that depend on positions and the dimensions. OK?
I just can't picture a regime where they're both valid.
Yeah, so okay, so I think I asked you to people to think about, has anyone convinced why it's true? No? Okay. So here is one way in which you can convince that it's true. So remember that we can choose four points in the plane, right? So I can put a point at 0, 1, and infinity. Sorry, 1, 0, 1 at infinity, and then there was one operator that I can put anywhere in the complex plane. Let's call it z. Z is a coordinate in the complex plane. So we have that. Now, in this choice, OK, so in this choice of coordinates, so I say x1 goes to 0, x2 equals z, that's a complex coordinate, x3 equals 1, 0, and x4 goes to infinity. If you evaluate the cross ratios here, what you're going to get? For u, you're going to get mod z squared. The x, these guys cancel, and you get just z square. And for b, I get 1 minus z square, because now I have x2 minus x3. Okay. So I'm just evaluating the cross ratios for this particular configuration. That will make it clear why there is an overlapping region of the, if I know how to draw, which is a non-trivial. Okay, so I have 0, I have 1. OK, infinity is far away. So and this operator z, I can think of it being here. OK? Now, I can either choose to expand around near 0 or around near 1. Let me make sure I draw this properly. So if I expand around, to have an operator here at z, okay? If I expand around zero, near 0, the nearest radius of convergence is until the next operator. So in the S channel, in this channel, the convergence is in this domain, in the complex plane. Oh. I'm already getting confused. Yeah, so it's okay. So essentially, the convergence is that z smaller than 1. So that's the sphere. Yeah, so this is the sphere. Okay, this should have been centered at, but sorry. So this is a radius one sphere. I'm sorry, yes. So this is the domain in which the this expansion is valid. Okay, because I'm expanding z around n equals zero, and the expansion is valid up to the next operator, which is at one. Now I can do the expansion in the other channel, where z is close to one. And now the point is that the expansion is valid. So essentially, okay, the first expansion is valid when mod z is less than one, okay? The second expansion is valid when one minus z smaller than one. But this is a sphere of radius one centered at one. And okay, if I know how to draw, which is not very clearly not my biggest forte, but this is a sphere of radius one around zero. This is a sphere of radius one around one. You see that there is an overlapping regime of convergence between in these two expansions. And therefore, if I compare the two functions in this domain, they have to agree.
So I have a question about the radius of convergence. So the radius of convergence isn't from, so in the first case, you're expanding around zero.
Yeah. And that, so then the next operator is at one.
Yeah, but if you pushed z a little bit closer to one, then z would be closer to one than it is to zero. So should is the radius of convergence not the distance from z to one rather than from zero to one?
Yes, because I'm replacing this guy by an operator at zero. So that expansion is valid up to the next operator, which is at one.
Okay.
And here I'm replacing the operator here and the operator here with a sum of operators here. And that converges until a sphere there.
Okay.
Okay. And therefore, this is a valid thing to impose, and in fact, it's a very powerful thing to impose. Okay, and from that, from this choice of two different expansions of the OPE, we get this equation now that was trivial before, and that we write using this decomposition has interesting meaning. So this equation is very non-trivial now. By evaluating GUV using the OPE, okay? So this is called the crossing equation, crossing symmetry equation. Oh, sorry, and here the expansion would be, we would write it like this. So you have one collides with four, two, three. So now what do we do with this? I mean, this is a very complicated equation. We don't really know how to deal with it in general. But this, let me tell you some things that you can say, and some things are old and some things are new. So something that are old that you can do is that when the space-time dimension is two, because in two dimensions you have extra conformal, remember that we discussed that in two dimensions the conformal symmetry is infinite dimensional, so you have more symmetries, and therefore very smart people were able to just look at this and say, I know the solution to this. And they essentially solved, if you wish, by pure thought, these equations. So this is quite remarkable. You have a conformal field theory, and just by imposing consistency conditions on the data of the CFT, you solve for the theory, which means that you know everything. You know the spectrum, you know the dimensions, and you know the three-prime functions, and therefore everything else. Okay. Yes.
How do you know you won't get additional constraints from the heart?
Oh, that's a good question. So this was at some point an exercise, but I don't know if it has been removed. So I encourage you to think about that. Imagine you take the five-point function. You can show that imposing that evaluation of the five-point function, all the different crossing channels will be satisfied if the four-point function is satisfied. So therefore, the bus stops here, as far as we know. Now, in two dimensions, crossing symmetry, it's known in two space-time dimensions that crossing symmetry is not the only constraint. There are other constraints that are called it's known as modular invariance. And I guess Tibra will discuss this or not, modular invariance. But you want to discuss modular invariance? Okay. So in two dimensions, there are, this is a very powerful constraint, but yet, there is yet another one that I have not discussed. In dimension three and higher, it is believed that this is the complete set of constraints on the data. There are no more constraints than this crossing symmetry equation. And for example, by doing this, you can discover an infinite family of conformal field theories that are called the minimal models. So these are two-dimensional conformal field theories that describe the critical behavior of statistical mechanics models in two dimensions, including the two-dimensionalizing model. And you solve for all the thermodynamics just by solving those equations, essentially, analytically. There is no small parameter anywhere. In fact, there are no parameters. And you just find the answer. And now in D equals three, you cannot really, I mean, there has been some analytic work on this. Most of the work has been numerical. So we know all these horrible functions explicitly. You know the power series representation in even dimensions, you know them explicitly in terms of products of hypergeometric functions. And you can try to study these equations in the computer. Okay. So in three dimensions, this has been used remarkably successfully to essentially, first of all, do two things. Prove something that a priori may not be very clear, that generic data, delta I and Cij, gives rise to an inconsistent conformal field theory. It's only for very special values of delta I and Cij that you can solve this equation. Okay? And then by a series of tricks, and also speculation, this is not really proven 100%, this equation essentially was used to solve for critical exponents of the three-dimensional Ising model. So this is a model that, again, you can get to it from the three-dimensional Ising lattice Hamiltonian and turning to the critical point. This is not a solvable model in any sense. And like in two dimensions, the two-dimensionalizing model can be solved explicitly on the lattice. And so in principle, you know everything. This one is definitely not a solvable model. But it's believed that it has a critical point. So the Ising model has a critical point at a particular temperature, the Curie temperature. And that's described by a conformal field theory. And one of the tasks for many decades was to, because also, by the way, this is relevant for nature. The three-dimensionalizing model is relevant for nature. So one of the things that you want to study is what is the thermodynamics behavior, what are the properties of the system, and in particular, the thermodynamics near the critical point. And that's governed precisely by the scaling dimensions. So what people did essentially by analyzing this equation and some conjectures, they essentially numerically, to extremely high precision, evaluated without using Feynman diagrams or anything of that sort that you may be familiar with, the critical exponents of the two relevant operators of the Ising model. So there are two relevant operators in the Ising model. One is it's called the spin operator. You can think of that as the spin at any point in the lattice, and then the energy operator. So what they found is that delta sigma is something like 0.518. Actually, this is known to 6 or 7 decimal points. Actually, now it's even better. I don't know. And the dimension of the energy operator is 1.4, essentially. And so this is quite amazing. First of all, it's the most, by a long shot, accurate determination of the critical exponent of the Ising model. And essentially, it's obtained by just pure thought. There is no semi-classical expansion you're doing here. You're solving the theory non-perturbatively, in some sense. So the beautiful thing about this equation is that it's one of the very few equations in physics that is non-perturbative. And we can try to just solve it in some way. Yes?
So
So what are some of the other primary operators in the IC model?
So, there are an infinite number of them, but most of them are irrelevant, and they also have been computed. I just listed the two relevant ones. Relevant means that these are the two ones that whose dimension is less than 3. Of course, there is the energy momentum tensor that has dimension 3. Okay, so now starting tomorrow or whenever, you will go deeper into this subject in the case of two dimensions where things can be done very analytically, okay? And essentially, all correlation functions are determined in terms of some differential equations that you can solve. Okay, so in the last part of the talk, I wanted to discuss something that is interesting for the subject, beyond the subject of conformal field theory, but also plays an important role in conformal field theory and beyond, in general in quantum field theory. So what I want to discuss now a little bit in the last half an hour or so, a little bit about anomalies. And just give you a flavor, and I'll discuss the concept of anomaly in two-dimensional, in conformal field theory, and it will connect to some things I discussed earlier in the course of how in the space of conformal field theories there is a quantity that gives you kind of an ordering that relates the logical RG flow structure between different conformal field theories, and that quantity is precisely the conformal anomaly. So first I have to tell you what an anomaly is. Okay. So this is an incredibly broad subject, and in fact, new things are being learned, I mean, in actual research even now, so I mean, it would be impossible to talk about all possible facets of it. So I will choose some particular path that I think it's conceptually simple to discover what an anomaly is. And maybe you will see this later in the psi year, I don't know. Okay. So let's start with first, what is a symmetry? So for this lecture, we will assume continuous symmetries. There are anomalies also for discrete symmetries, but let's postpone that for later. So we know from Noether's theorem that associated to a continuous symmetry, there's a conserved current, delta mu j mu equals 0. Okay. So that the divergence of the current vanishes on shell. Okay. That's one characterization of what a symmetry is. And associated to the current, we have a charge. That is time independent. Now, it could happen that a symmetry that, so this is something derived using the classical Lagrangian, right? Now, it can happen, and it does happen, that there are symmetries that do not survive the process of quantization. You know, when you give you a classical theory, you have to quantize it, right? And the question is, can you quantize it while preserving the symmetries? Okay. So an anomaly is essentially a violation. It's a quantum violation of a conservation law. So essentially what you find is that when you try to quantize the theory, there is no way in which, and you can try to be clever and you change your, sometimes, you know, in quantum field theory, we have to define regulators, right? And you might say, okay, my regulator does not preserve that symmetry, but maybe someone clever than me will find a regulator to preserve that symmetry. An anomaly is essentially an object that there is no smart person in the world that will make it go away. Okay? It's an irreducible obstruction to the conservation law. So essentially what you find is that d mu, j mu is non-zero, and it's something that's of order h bar. Okay. Now you might think, okay, if a symmetry is anomalous, then this is horrible. Well, first of all, the word anomaly gives it a very bad connotation. Like an anomaly is something not good, right? At least in Spanish, it's not good. I don't know in English, but actually, it's exactly the opposite. The fact that there are anomalies for global symmetries actually is what gives us very powerful constraints on the possible dynamics that can emerge from such a theory. Okay? So I don't know how much time I will have to really explain why that's the case. But that's one of the important applications of anomalies. Okay. Now, to just very briefly. So even though, yeah, so you could have an anomaly in a, so there are two kinds of, even though the word, I don't like the word, but I'll say the word the textbook say. So there are two kinds of symmetries in life. There are gauge symmetries and there are global symmetries, okay? So gauge symmetries are something that you have are redundancies in your description, and they're usually there to make the theory local by adding redundant variables, okay? Now, a violation of a gauge symmetry gives rise to an inconsistency, because gauge symmetry allows you to project out negative norm states, okay? So if you have a gauge symmetry and that gauge symmetry is anomalous, then you throw the theory to the basket, just garbage. Well, I mean, garbage means that it does not respect the rules of quantum mechanics. Unitarity is lost. I mean, if you're willing to entertain non-unitary theories, you're welcome to. And in fact, it is a miracle of life that if you look at this, I believe you're taking the standard model, right? Take the standard model. It's on the cutting edge of dying because of gauge anomalies, and it's a miracle that it doesn't die. Like it, by summing over leptons and quarks and over all generations, you always land on your feet. This is a miracle, okay? But it's very non-trivial. And now, okay, so that's for gauge symmetries. For global symmetries, an anomaly is not a problem. It just means that the symmetry is not there. But the anomaly still has the repercussions for the and implications for the theory. Okay. So now let's discuss an example that's close to what we've been discussing, which will be the conformal anomaly in two dimensions. So let's say the conformal anomaly. And I do it in two dimensions because things are simpler. Actually, you can try to do the exercise I'm doing here in higher dimensions. So what did we say? We said that essentially conformal invariants implied something, a conservation law, which was that the trace of the energy momentum tensor vanished. Remember that? So now we want to study whether the trace of the energy momentum tensor can be violated quantum mechanically, so that there's a non-zero right-hand side. So now there are many ways of studying this. One way, and I'll do both, but I'll start with kind of from the poor man's point of view. There is a more geometric way of talking about anomalies, and which relates to cohomology and blah blah blah. But we'll start from a very pedestrian point of view. So let's discover how an anomaly in a two-dimensional conformal field theory is unavoidable, essentially. And defines a quantity that will be very important for us, the quantity C of the C theorems that I discussed earlier in the course. So before we start, we're going to do the following exercise. And actually, I believe this will literally be an exercise for you in one of the tutorials. So let's start by considering the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor in momentum space. It will be useful for me to be in momentum space. You could do it in position space. I am very open-minded. But I prefer to do it in position space. And here I impose essentially translational invariants. So this guy carries momentum p. This guy carries momentum minus p. Okay. So now what I'm going to do is to write down the most general thing that you can write down. So what we're going to write down is the most general two-point function of the energy momentum tensor, which is consistent, of course, with the Lorentz invariants and the symmetry of the energy momentum tensor, right? The energy momentum tensor is symmetric, so it has to have all the symmetries that the left-hand side has, and it has to be Lorentz covariant. So what are the building blocks that you can use to write things on the right here? What is available to you? The metric, what else? Anything else? What was that? P, exactly. So what you have to do is the exercise of writing the more general thing that you can build out of the metric and the momentum, okay? So can someone give me an example of something that can appear there that would make sense?
Could you have like four P's?
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. Just say it. I mean, whatever you think it's right, it's right. I mean, this is not tricky. Just yeah. So this would be one of them. And then a function of p squared, because this is a Lorentz scalar. So I can multiply this tensor structure by an arbitrary function of p squared. Can you have a structure without any momenta? Is that possible? Two metrics. And actually, you can convince yourself that there are two different ways of doing that. One is this one, with another function, let's call it f1, f2. And another one would be where you have eta mu rho eta nu sigma plus symmetrizations, so that the symmetries on the left-hand side and the right-hand side are the same with f3 p squared. Okay, so in the exercise, you're going to do this, just write the more general thing, and there are five different structures. You can write down. Now, let's impose the following condition. So the energy momentum, so now let's impose the following. Let's say that, let's impose translational invariance. That's a statement that the energy momentum tensor is conserved, right? In momentum space, that p mu, t mu nu equals zero. If I write something that's crazy, you tell me. I'm just gonna go on assuming that this is straightforward. That's just this conservation law written in momentum space, essentially. Okay? So now you can say, I just wrote the more general thing consistent with Lorentz invariance. Now I impose momentum conservation. This will impose relations between the various functions. Okay? Because I have to say, if I act with p mu here, the right hand side will have to vanish. Okay? And we'll give you a set of constraints. In fact, we'll give you three relations among the five different structures that you can write down. Okay, and then it will be convenient to introduce an object that you may have seen in general relativity or in field theory. Let's define an object which is manifestly symmetric and divergent-less. So let's define a two tensor, pi mu nu, that is symmetric and divergence-less. Do you know how to write down such an object? You have definitely seen this in QED in some language. Okay. Yeah, so P mu, P nu.
Minus
p squared eta mu nu. Precise. Oh, did you say that or?
I forgot that.
Yeah, okay, fine. Close enough. Okay, so this guy is obviously conserved, right? If I act with p, the two sides cancel, and it's obviously symmetric. So then, once you impose the constraints that follow from transitional invariance here, I can write down the two-point function using this tensor. So the most general two-point function of a conserved energy momentum tensor in two dimensions takes this form. And this is a geometric interpretation. There is a contribution that comes from a spin zero part and a contribution that comes from a spin two part. So this will be like the coefficients I'm not going to care too much about because they're not important. Have pi mu rho pi mu sigma plus pi mu sigma pi mu rho minus 2 over d minus 1 pi mu nu pi rho sigma, a function f of p squared plus pi mu nu pi rho sigma some function g of p squared. The first object here is a symmetric traceless tensor. So you could think of this as the spin 2 contribution to the correlator. This guy is the spin 0 contribution to the correlator. Okay? Ah, by the way, so here, by the way, I have not, until here, I have not specified, I'm still in general dimensions D. There was nothing here that was special about 2 dimensions until now. Now something special will happen in 2 dimensions. Notice that I have here the D, right? So now let's go to 2 dimensions. Now, what happens in 2 dimensions? This guy, the coefficient of this guy becomes 2, right? So can someone tell me what happens to this thing in the bracket in 2 dimensions? It vanishes. So let me maybe spell out in 2 steps why it vanishes. In 2 dimensions, this guy will vanish simply because it's useful to define in 2 dimensions a derived momentum epsilon mu p tilde mu, which is epsilon mu alpha p alpha. Okay. Then a simple exercise shows you that p mu nu is p tilde mu p tilde nu. And this follows from an identity that the epsilon tensor satisfies in 2 dimensions, that epsilon mu alpha, epsilon nu beta is the same as eta mu nu, eta alpha beta, minus eta mu beta, eta alpha nu. So if I compute p tilde mu, p tilde nu, and I use this identity, I precisely get this thing, okay? Let me not spend time proving this. This is straightforward, okay? So that means that all these terms are just the product of 4 p tildes, right? But I get the sum of 2 terms with coefficient 2 minus the sum of 2 terms with coefficient 2, so it vanishes. So in 2 dimensions, that's where the simplification comes. So in 2 space-time dimensions, we're left with the following. There is a purpose to all of this, trust me. So we have that t mu nu p t rho sigma minus p is essentially some coefficient I'm going to call c. Well, p mu nu p rho sigma, some function of p squared. Okay? It's conserved. And now one question that we want, okay, so here so far I've only imposed translation and Poincaré invariance and conservation. Now let's impose a scaling symmetry. This is essentially the statement that the dimensional analysis makes sense. The dimensions on the left have to be the same as the dimensions on the right. Now, can someone tell me what is the dimension of the energy momentum tensor in momentum space? Okay, what is it in position space? Someone says something. I mean, there is a finite number of possibilities, so. What quantity do we derive out of the energy momentum tensor? The momentum operator we derive out of the energy momentum tensor by integrating the energy momentum tensor over a special surface, right? And the momentum operator has dimension 1. So that means that the energy momentum tensor has dimension of D, the space-time dimension. So the dimension of T mu nu is D. Is that not crazy, or does it sound crazy? Because otherwise I have to spend more time explaining this. But of course, we're doing the Fourier transform. We're in position space, right? So I'm integrating this guy over d dx. So the dimension of t mu, or the dimension of t mu nu in momentum space is 0, okay? Because I have a contribution from the d dx that cancels the contribution of the mu. So now we have to make an object here that has, so the left-hand side has dimension zero, the right-hand side has to have dimension zero, and I leave you to think about that the right hand, that this fixes completely the function gp squared. It has to be some homogeneous function of p squared such that the dimensions match, right? We're just matching indices and dimensions, okay? We're not doing anything more than that. So this function has to be one over p squared, okay? With some coefficient c that a priori we don't know, okay? Good. So now we are poised to ask the question about the trace anomalies. Remember, we know that conformal invariance is the statement that the trace of the energy momentum tensor vanishes, right? Now let's compute the trace. So far here, all that we did is just impose like vanilla things. We impose Lorentz invariance and conservation law. Now we have to see the theory will tell us what happens. So if I now take this and I evaluate the trace of t mu no, so by contracting with eta mu nu, what happens? I get eta mu nu acting on p mu nu. What is that? What is eta mu nu contracted with p mu nu? It's p squared up to some coefficient we don't care about, okay? So that p squared, okay, so let me point here. So if I contract eta mu nu with p mu nu, I get p squared. I click at 1 minus d p squared. This cancels this p squared, okay? So I get that t mu mu p t rho sigma minus p, I get c times p rho sigma, pi rho sigma, right? Now, this looks bad because the theory was a scale invariant, a conformal invariant. What happened now that I have inside correlation functions where t mu mu, the trace of t mu mu is not zero. I have some right-hand side, okay? Now, what I want to discuss now is that the violation is a very mild violation, okay? Now, let's try to think more physically of this. You probably have more intuition about position space. Let's try to go to position space, okay? So what is this p rho sigma? P rho sigma is a polynomial in momentum, right? Essentially p squared. What is the Fourier transform of a polynomial of p? Okay, what is the Fourier transform of 1? I'm deaf, so you don't speak louder. You said something. Yeah, Kronecker delta, yeah. So what would be the Fourier transform of p squared?
Second derivative.
So polynomials in momenta, Fourier transform to derivatives of the delta function, okay? So from here, what you're going to get, so if I go now to position space, what I'm going to get is d rho, so c, d rho d sigma minus eta rho sigma . Okay, so what do we find? First, what we find, let's look at this equation and just try to understand what this equation is trying to tell us. What we find is the delta function is famously has support only at the origin, right? So it tells us that the violation of the tracelessness of the energy momentum tensor only happens at one point where this operator collides with this operator, okay? So that means that there is a violation of conformal symmetry only at coincident points. Which means that when this operator sits on top of this other one. If you analyze your correlation function of the conformal field theory at separated points, you'll never discover the anomaly. You only discover it if you allow the operators to sit on top of others, okay? And there is no way of getting rid of this, okay? There is no way of So you could think, okay, I can get rid of the anomaly. Why don't I put C equals zero? Then the right-hand side will be zero. But that's unphysical, because that would be the statement that the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor vanishes. That's not a tenable, that's not physical. The energy momentum tensor is a non-trivial operator, and the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor cannot be zero. Otherwise, if the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor is zero, it means that the energy momentum tensor is zero, and that's only true, essentially, in topological field theories. Okay? So you cannot say, oh, I'm going to save the theory from the conformal anomaly by putting C to zero, because then you throw the whole theory down the garbage, essentially. So C, if you wish, C, this defines a quantity C that measures the violation of conformal invariance. And notice that we haven't done any magic tricks. We just did like very elementary things of symmetries plus conservation laws and saw that there was an obstruction. No one, you know, no genius will come and fix this, okay? This is it. There is no solution. There is no way around this, okay? So now something that's very useful in general that I want to describe for a second is that this violation of the trace of the energy momentum tensor at coincident points can be made valid at separated points by doing the following thing. What we can do is we can couple, let me just be brief with that. Actually, this maybe is part of the exercise, I don't know. One thing that we can try to do now is the following. We studied the conformal field theory in flat space, in flat Minkowski space. We can try now to couple the theory to a background fiducial metric, okay? The metric is not dynamical, it's just a background field. Okay, like, you know, in the lab, people turn electric magnetic fields. This is like turning on a gravitational field by putting a heavy apple nearby. I don't know. Okay, so what do I want to compute? I want to compute the trace of the energy momentum tensor in the presence of a background gravitational field. Now, what does this mean in words? This is in the presence of a particular, so turning on a background metric is the same as adding an operator in the Lagrangian. Can someone tell me which operator in the Lagrangian do I do when I couple the theory to a background metric infinitesimally? Which operator couples to the metric? The energy momentum tensor. So the linearized coupling of a field theory to a background metric is through the energy momentum tensor. So what I'm doing is tying the theory with this perturbation. And this is in the unperturbed theory. Is it clear what I did here? That's how you couple a background field to a current. So for electromagnetism, you couple to the background Gates field, A mu, J mu. For the metric, you couple T mu to the metric. Okay, so now I'm studying my conformal field theory that had this had this anomaly at coincident points, and now I want to study it in a weak gravitational field that is non-dynamical. Now, how can we compute this thing? How could you compute these correlators, say, using perturbation theory? I could bring this guy down, right? So by bringing this guy down, the guy that will contribute will be d2x, the two-point function of t mu mu at zero. Okay. There's too many. Let me call it rho sigma, okay? T rho sigma at x, h rho sigma at x, okay? All I did is to bring that fellow down, right? Is that clear what I did? I'm just evaluating the
you're expanding the exponential, right?
Yes.
So what happened to the...
It's zero. Remember, the one-point function of any operator is zero except for the identity. Okay. But now we computed this, right? So what we got is this derivative acting on a delta function. So let's plug that into there, and we will arrive to some beautiful structure that you know from general relativity. So what I get here is d2x C times d rho d sigma minus box eta rho sigma acting on h rho, sorry, acting on delta 2 of x, h rho sigma of x, right? But now I can integrate by parts. I can have these two derivatives. Instead of acting on the delta function, I can make it act on the metric perturbation, right? And then the integral over delta function I can just do, okay? So from here I get that this is C times d rho d sigma minus eta rho sigma acting on h rho sigma. So what's the conclusion from this exercise? What we define is that the violation of conformal symmetry at coincident points in flat space becomes a violation everywhere in the presence of a weak gravitational field. So from this equation, we discover that the trace of T mu mu is this C Now, this is all happening in a theory that is, by definition, diffeomorphism is transitional invariant and diffeomorphism invariant. That's the statement that the energy momentum was conserved. Diffeomorphism invariant is the same as saying that the energy momentum is conserved, right? So that means that whatever appears here on the right-hand side has to be a diffeomorphism invariant quantity. And what I've done is compute for you the linearized form of this diffeomorphism invariant quantity. So can you recognize what this quantity is? Well, I want something more precise. So Einstein's equations has floating indices, right? Do you see any floating indices there?
No.
Okay. So which tensor is that? First of all, it's a scalar. Okay, what scalars do you know that are diffeomorphism invariant?
The Ricci.
The Ricci scalar. Essentially, this is just C times R linearized around eta mu nu plus h mu nu. Okay. So what we find is that the conformal anomaly, once you couple the conformal field theory to a curve metric, is governed by this quantity C, which plays an important role, times the Ricci scalar. If we had been, okay, so now that I told you that, I can ask for some guesswork. So imagine now we try to do the same, run the same exercise in D equals 3. So the first thing that you need to know is two things have to happen. Things have to be consistent with dimensional analysis and with the diffeomorphism invariance. I already told you that the trace of the energy momentum tensor in position space has dimension d. So in three dimensions, we'll have dimension 3. And whatever appears on the right-hand side has to be diffeomorphism invariant because the energy momentum tensor is conserved by fiat, okay? So what thing, even forget about all this computation, can you just guess what you can write down here in three dimensions? Okay, the point is that there is nothing you can write down. That was slightly tricky, but not completely. I mean, the thing that you know, like the Riemann tensor, the Ricci tensor, all of that, have dimension 2, right? Has two derivatives. There is no local object you can write down in three dimensions that would be diffeomorphism invariant. And that's the famous statement that conformal anomalies, there are no conformal anomalies in odd space-time dimensions. Yes?
By local, what do you mean, analytic or?
Yes.
So there couldn't be a square root or
anything? No, because anomalies always have to be local because the anomalies come from UV regularization. And the effect of the UV is analytic in momenta, which means if you go to position space, it means that it's local. But in four dimensions, for example, you can do the same exercise and you would find that T mu mu, you can have things like R square. Actually, you can write essentially, you can organize, so now this has dimension 4. So now you cannot write Ricci anymore, right? Because Ricci would have dimension 2. You have to write something that has dimension 4. But you can construct essentially two independent invariants. You can
the Levi-Civita and the two Ricci tensors.
You can so you can also construct one of Levi-Civita. But what I wanted to say is that you can combine the Riemann, the Ricci, and the Ricci scalar into two different invariants. That one is the Weyl. Have you heard of the Weyl tensor? Okay, so something that is a Weyl square tensor with a coefficient C, and then a coefficient that's what's called the Euler density. This is a topological invariant that you can construct out of the Riemann, Ricci, and tensor. Okay. This is some like R mu nu rho square plus coefficients that, of course, I don't know, plus things like that. Sorry? Oh, wow. Which is minus four? Ah, I shouldn't be doing your homework. I'm sorry. That's illegal. Okay. So now let me just conclude with a few words of why this, because I feel it, otherwise I want to tie a loose end. So what is this C? So something that actually in some previous years in exercises you have shown, I don't know if you're going to show it in this year, is that C, remember that before we studied this idea that you start with a conformal fluid theory in the ultraviolet, you turn on an operator, relevant operator, and you flow to a conformal fluid theory in the infrared. We discussed that there is a quantity in a conformal field theory that gives a logical relation between the theories that can be obtained from an RG flow of a given theory. Okay? And what we said is there was a quantity that's monotonic under RG flow. And that fits a little bit with the intuition of RG flow. RG flow means what? That you start with some high energy scale, and as you flow to the infrared, you integrate out heavy particles, right? And you lose degrees of freedom, right? So this C is kind of a measure of the degrees of freedom of the theory. And therefore, intuitively, this is not tightly precise, but intuitively correct, that the reason that C is smaller in the infrared than in the UV is that C is a measure of the number of degrees of freedom. Okay. Now, that's also not intuitive from this point of view. If you compute the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor, and you have 75 particles, C will grow with the number of particles. So C is kind of a measure of the number of degrees of freedom. Okay. So the thing that's remarkable is that the quantity that gives you roadmaps in the space of conformal field theories about the logical structure of RG flows is precisely the conformal anomaly. And the same is true in four dimensions. In that case, the quantity that measures the monotonicity of the RG flow is a horrible coincidence, but you know, it's A. So this is an example, just a very tiny glimpse, and this could be like a 3-week lecture in itself, of how anomalies really constrain very dramatically the dynamics, because they enter as kind of roadmaps in the abstract space of field theories where in general, you have very little control over the dynamics because it's non-perturbative. But nevertheless, since anomalies are robust quantities, they're in a certain precise mathematical sense topological, you can make very broad blank statements like this without knowing how to solve the dynamics. But for example, if you tell me that the RG flow from this theory to the, you have a proposal for the RG flow of this theory by a relevant operator, if I compute C and it doesn't obey this, I tell you, you're wrong, I'm sorry, try again. So it's really a very powerful constraint that actually we use all the time to constrain the dynamics of non-perturbative theories. So with that, I think I'll stop. Yeah, thank you. Yes?
So in 2D, the Ricci scalar is the Euler density in two dimensions, right?
Yes.
Does this pattern continue in 6D?
Yeah, so there is
the log term in 6D.
Yes. But of course, the number of invariants you can construct as you go in higher dimensions is bigger, so it becomes.
So what choice do you make?
But the thing that's important is the one that measures the monotonicity is always the coefficient of the topological Euler density. Yeah. But you get horrible, different wild to whatever power contractions.